The corridor outside the row of emergency theatres was lined along each wall with stretchers, and the brig recognised many of his guests laid out upon them. He stopped briefly to speak with one or two of them before following Edelman to the recovery room at the end of the corridor. Deborah lay on the tall bed below the window. She was very pale. Dry blood was still clotted in her hair, and a thick cotton wool and bandage dressing covered both her eyes. "Your father is here, Miss Mordecai," Edelman told her, and she rolled her head swiftly towards them. "Daddy, I'm here, my child." The brig took the hand she held out and stooped to kiss her. Her lips were cold, and she smelled strongly of disinfectant and anaesthetic. "Mama?" she asked anxiously. "She is out of danger," the brig assured her. "But Hannah..." "Yes, they told me," Deborah stopped him, her voice choking. "Is Joe all right?" "He is strong," the brig said. "He will be all right." "David?" she asked. "He is here." Eagerly, she struggled up onto one elbow, her face lighting with expectation, the heavily bound eyes turned blindly seeking. "David," she called, "where are you? Damn this bandage. Don't worry, David, it's just to rest my eyes." "No." The brig restrained her with a hand on her arm. "He is outside waiting." And she slumped with disappointment. "Ask him to come to me, please," she whispered. "Yes," said the brig. "In a while. But first there's something we must talk about. Something I have to tell you." She must have guessed what it was. She must have been warned by the tone of his voice, for she went very still, that peculiar stillness of hers like a frightened animal of the veldt. He was a soldier, with a soldier's blunt ways, and although he tried to soften it, yet even his tone was roughened with his own sorrow, so that it came out brutally. Her hand in his was the only indication that she had heard him. It spasmed convulsively like a wounded thing and then lay still, a small, tense hand in the circle of his big, bony fist. She asked no questions, and when he had done, they sat quietly together for a long time. He spoke first. "I will send David to you now," he said, and her response was swift and vehement. "No." She gripped his hand hard. "No, I can't see him now. I have to think about this first." The brig went back to the waiting room, and David stood up expectantly, the pure lines of his face seemingly carved from pale polished marble, and the dark blue of his eyes in deep contrast. The brig forestalled him harshly. "No visitors." He took David's arm. "You will not be allowed to see her until tomorrow." "Is something wrong? What is it?" David tried to pull away. But the brig held him and steered him towards the door. "Nothing is wrong. She will be all right, but she must have no excitement now. You'll be able to see her tomorrow." They buried Hannah that evening in the family plot on the Mountain of Olives. It was a small funeral party, attended by the three men and a mere handful of relatives, many of whom had others to mourn from the previous day's slaughter. There was an official car waiting to take the brig to a meeting of the High Command, where retaliatory measures would certainly be discussed. Another revolution in the relentless wheel of violence that rolled across the troubled land. Joe and David climbed into the Mercedes and sat silently, David making no effort to start the engine. Joe lit cigarettes for them, and they both felt drained of purpose and direction. "What are you going to do now?" David asked him. "We had 2 weeks," Joe answered him. "We were going down to Ashkelon." His voice trailed off. "I don't know. There isn't anything to do now, is there?" "Shall we go and have a drink somewhere?" Joe shook his head. "I don't feel like drinking," he said. "I think I'll go back to the base. They're flying night interceptions tonight." "Yes," David agreed quickly. "I'll come with you." He could not see Deborah until tomorrow, and the house on Malik Street would be lonely and cold. Suddenly he longed for the peace of the night heavens. The moon was a brightly curved Saracen blade against the soft darkness of the sky, and the stars were fat and silver and gem-like in their clarity. They flew high above the earth, remote from its grief and sorrow, wrapped in the isolation of flight and lost in the ritual and concentration of night interception. The target was a mirage of their own squadron, and they picked it up on the scanner far out over the Negev. Joe locked onto it and called the track and range while David searched for and at last spotted the moving star of the target's jet blast, burning redly against the velvety blackness of the night. He took them in on a clean interception, creeping up under the target's belly, and then pulling steeply up past its wingtip, the way a barracuda goes for the lure from below and explodes out through the surface of the sea. They shot past so close that the target mirage broke wildly away to port, unaware of their presence until that moment. Joe slept that night exhausted with grief, but David lay in the bunk beneath him and listened to him. In the dawn, he rose and showered and left Joe still asleep. He drove into Jerusalem and reached the hospital just as the sun came up and lit the hills with its rays of soft gold and pearly pink. The night sister at the desk was brusque and preoccupied. "You shouldn't be here until visiting hours this afternoon." But David smiled at her with all the charm he could muster. "I just wanted to know if she's doing well. I have to rejoin my squadron this morning." The sister was not immune either to his smile or the Air Force uniform, and she went to consult her lists. "You must be mistaken," she said at last. "The only Mordecai we have is Mrs. Ruth Mordecai." "That's her mother," David told her, and the sister flipped the sheet on her clipboard. "No wonder I couldn't find it," she muttered irritably. "She was discharged last night." "Discharged?" David stared at her uncomprehendingly. "Yes, she went home last night. I remember her now. Her father came to fetch her just as I came on duty. A pretty girl with eye bandages." "Yes," David nodded. "Thank you. Thank you very much." And he ran down the steps to the Mercedes, his feet light with relief, freed at last from the gnawing doubt and dread. Deborah had gone home. Deborah was safe and well. The brig opened the door to him and let him into the silent house. He was still in his uniform, and it was wilted and rumpled. The brig's face was fine drawn, the lines crudely chiseled around his mouth, and his eyes were swollen and bloodshot from worry and sorrow and lack of sleep. "Where's Deborah?" David demanded eagerly, and the brig sighed and stood aside for him to enter. "Where is she?" David repeated, and the brig led him to his study and waved him to a chair. "Why don't you answer me?" David was becoming angry. And the brig slumped into a chair across the large bare room with its severe monastic furnishings of books and archaeological relics. "I couldn't tell you yesterday, David. She asked me not to. I'm sorry." "What is it?" David was fully alarmed now. "She had to have time to think, to make up her mind." The brig stood up again and began to pace, his footsteps echoing hollowly on the bare wooden floor, pausing every now and then to touch one of the pieces of ancient statuary, caressing it absently as he talked, as though to draw comfort from it. David listened quietly, occasionally shaking his head, as though to deny that what he was hearing was the truth. "So you see, it is permanent, final, without hope. She's blind, David, totally blind. She has gone into a dark world of her own where nobody else can follow her. Where is she? I want to go to her," David whispered, but the brig ignored the request and went on steadily. "She wanted time to make her decision, and I gave it to her. Last night after the funeral, I went back to her, and she was ready. She had faced it, come to terms with it, and she had decided how it must be." "I want to see her," David repeated. "I want to talk to her." Now the brig looked at him, and the bleakness in his eyes faded. His voice dropped, becoming gruff with compassion. "No, David. That was her decision. You will not see her again. For you, she is dead. Those were her words. Tell him I am dead. But he must only remember me when I was alive," David interrupted him, jumping to his feet. "Where is she, damn you?" His voice was shaking. "I want to see her now." He crossed swiftly to the door and jerked it open. But the brig went on. "She's not here." "Where is she?" David turned back. "I cannot tell you. I swore a solemn oath to her. I'll find her. You might, if you search carefully. But you will forfeit any respect or love she may have for you," the brig went on remorselessly. "Again, I will give you her exact words. Tell him that I charge him on our love, on all we have ever been to each other, that he will let me be, that he will not come looking for me. Why? But why? David demanded desperately. Why does she reject me? She knows that she is altered beyond all hope or promise. She knows that what was before can never be again. She knows that she can never be to you again what you have a right to expect. He stopped David's protest with an angry chopping gesture of his hand. Listen to me. She knows that it cannot endure. She can never be your wife now. You are too young, too vital, too arrogant. David stared at him. She knows that it will begin to spoil. In a week, a month, a year, perhaps, it will have died. You will be trapped, tied to a blind woman. She doesn't want that. She wants it to die now, swiftly, mercifully, not to drag on. Stop it! David shouted. Stop it, damn you, that's enough! He stumbled to the chair and fell into it. They were silent for a while. David crouched in the chair with his face buried in his hands. The brig standing before the narrow window casement, the early morning light catching the fierce old warrior's face. She asked me to make you promise, he hesitated, and David looked up at him. To promise that you would not try to find her. No, David shook his head stubbornly. The brig sighed. If you refused, I was to tell you this. She said you would understand, although I don't. She said that in Africa there is a fierce and beautiful animal called the sable antelope, and sometimes one of them is wounded by a hunter or mauled by a lion. The words were as painful as the cut of a whiplash, and David remembered himself saying them to her once when they were both young and strong and invulnerable. Very well, he murmured at last. If that's what she wants, then I promise not to try and find her. Though I don't promise not to try and convince her she's wrong. Perhaps it would be best if you left Israel, the brig told him. Perhaps you should go back to where you came from and forget all of this ever happened. David paused, considering this a moment, before he answered. No. All I have is here. I will stay here. Good. The brig accepted the decision. You are always welcome in this house. Thank you, sir, said David, and went out to where the Mercedes was parked. He let himself into the house on Malik Street and saw instantly that someone had been there before him. He walked slowly into the living room. The books were gone from the olive wood table. The Kadesh painting no longer hung above the leather couch. In the bathroom, he opened the wall cabinet, and all her toilet articles had been removed. The rows of exotic bottles, the tubes and pots, even the slot for her toothbrush beside his was empty. Her cupboard was bare, the dresses gone, the shelves blank. Every trace of her swept away, except for the lingering scent of her perfume on the air and the ivory lace cover upon the bed. He went to the bed and sat upon it, stroking the fine lacework, remembering how it had been. There was the hard outline of something thin and square upon the pillow beneath the cover. He turned back the lace and picked up the thin green book. This year in Jerusalem. It had been left there as a parting gift. The title swam and went misty before his eyes. It was all he had left of her. It seemed as though the slaughter at Ain Karim was the signal for a fresh upsurge of hostility and violence throughout the Middle East. A planned escalation of international tensions as the Arab nations rattled their impressive oil-purchased array of weaponry and swore once more to leave not a single Jew in the land they still called Palestine. There were savage and merciless attacks on soft targets, ill-protected embassies and consulates around the world, letter bombs and night ambushes on school buses in isolated areas. Then the provocations grew bolder, more directly aimed at the heart of Israel. Border infringements, commando-style raids, violations of airspace, shellings, and a threatening gathering and massing of armed might along the long, vulnerable frontiers of the wedge-shaped territories of the tiny land. The Israelis waited, praying for peace, but girt for war. Day after day, month after month, David and Joe flew to maintain that degree of expertise where instinct and instantaneous reaction superseded conscious thought and reasoned action. At those searing speeds beyond sound, it was only this training that swung the advantage from one combat team to another. Even the superior reaction times of these carefully handpicked young men were unequal to the tasks of bringing their mighty machines into effective action, where latitudes of error were measured in hundredths of a second, until they had attained this extrasensory perfection. To seek out, to recognize, to close, to destroy, and to disengage, it was a total preoccupation that blessedly left little time for brooding and sorrow. Yet the sorrow and anger that David and Joe shared seemed doubly to arm them. Their vengeance was all-consuming. Soon they joined that select half-dozen strike teams that Desert Flower called to undertake the most delicate of sorties. Again and again they were ordered into combat, and each time the confidence that command had in them was strengthened. As David sat in his cockpit, dressed from head to foot in the stiff, constricting embrace of a full pressure suit, breathing oxygen from his closed face mask, although the Mirage still crouched upon the ground, there were four black, red, and white miniature roundels painted on the fuselage below his cockpit, the scalps of the enemy. It was a mark of Desert Flower's trust that Bright Lance Flight had been selected for high-altitude red standby. With the stator lines plugged ready to blow compressed air into the compressors and whirl the great engines into life, and the ground crew lounging beside the motor, the Mirages were ready to be hurled aloft in a matter of seconds. Both David and Joe were suited to survive the almost pressureless altitudes above 60,000 feet, where an unprotected man's blood would fizzle like champagne. David had lost count of the weary, uncomfortable days and hours he had sat cramped in his cockpit on red standby, with only the regular 15-minute checks to break the monotony. Checking 11:15 hours, 15 minutes to stand down, David said into the microphone, and heard Joe's breathing in his ears before the reply. Two standing by, Beseda.